Hi, and welcome to Dr. Dark After Dark number 32. What's going on? Also, we're going to do a little bit of a Q&A. So we've done a whole bunch of interviews recently. I hope you guys have enjoyed them. They've been super fun to do. A big variety of guests. In general, the feedback I've been getting is people like the kind of unstructured, unedited, just basically it is what it is way we've been doing it. So kind of plan to carry on doing it like that. It also makes it easier for me. It means I can also get them out instantly. And a lot of the stuff's very topical. So yeah, thanks for all your support. And also thanks for the kind of feedback people have given and the questions that have come in. So I'm going to answer some of those today. We're going to talk a bit about volatility. That's come up a lot. And I'm going to give an update on the kind of my quest to understand how reserves work. I had more conversations with various people on that. But I wanted to start with just a kind of almost like a market update. So in Asia time, it's actually Friday, September the 11th. So 19 years ago was the horrible terrorist attacks. So we should give a moment of respect on that. And the markets are also, you know, kind of being logical in some ways, illogical in others. So why don't we just start with equities? So everyone's talking about tech, right? NASDAQ, you know, and what we've seen is this, well, and of course personified by something like a Tesla, for example, you know, and if you look at Tesla, it has that absolute classic kind of blow off top pattern where it's, so what, when people say that, what they really mean is you've got to think of the gradient of the price action. So it's easiest to see if you just put, instead of having candles, just put a line with say closing prices. And if that line really starts to ramp up almost exponentially, or indeed exponentially, then, you know, and then has like a quick down, you know, and that down could be 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%. It depends, right? And then kind of comes up to retest, which is the bull trap. And then if it breaks below that first low point after the peak, that's kind of what Rahul would call the GMI crash pattern. It's a pretty common thing. I mean, actually, if you look at Bitcoin's top in 2017, it's identical to this. It's very, very, very common. And it's just because of psychology, right? So people are bidding up, whether it's Tesla or Apple, Microsoft, tech in general, whatever it is, and just ignoring things like dealers being short gamma and this type of stuff, but just thinking purely about psychology, you get the blow off top because, you know, everyone's, you know, the last few people are crowding into the trade, you know, and then people start to sell. And then, you know, again, anyone that thinks they can exactly sell the top every time is lying to you. Some people will sell the top, but very few. So what's interesting on this is we've had that first leg down. So NASDAQ, I think, what, it's like 12%, 13% down, something like that, which is, again, nothing. I mean, this is where NASDAQ was like 2 weeks ago. So let's also be, you know, cognizant of that fact. One thing I know is kind of silly to do, but I like doing is to, in effect, ignore the blow-off top bit and just draw the trend line. And actually, you know, does it look reasonable or not? Now, if it still doesn't look reasonable, i.e. it's gone up too much and you've taken off the blow off top, that probably is another sign. So we've come down, there's roughly 12%. It's kind of tried to nudge up a couple of times. Is it really the bull trap? Don't know. We need more data. But the point is you don't need to trade this, right? You can just wait. So if we, so I think NASDAQ went back up to somewhere around 11,500. It's now looking like it's trending down towards 11,000 again. So again, you can just wait. If it breaks significantly below 11,000, makes new lows, that's pretty bearish. But if it breaks upwards above 11,500 with some momentum, then that could be pretty, really, really bullish, right? So in some ways, you don't have to make a decision that. Now, you could say, I just want to be long volatility, i.e. you want to buy, say, a straddle, just at the money straddle would be one, I think, pretty logical thing right now. Volatility is a little more expensive right now because of the crash. So, well, not the crash, but the correction, whatever you want to call it. So you're not getting, NASDAQ volatility index, so the VIXEN, VXN, it's not like it's at its lows where it was a month or two back. So, it straddles will cost you more. In effect, that means you're going to be getting less time for your money for them to play out. But if you think there's going to be a big move either way, that could be a pretty logical thing to do. For those new to options, straddles are just when you buy a call and a put at the same expiry at the same strike price. And really it's a volatility play. So, and that may seem like a stupid thing to do. Like, well, why do I want to buy a call and a put? Like, surely I'm going to lose because the market goes one way, right? Like, well, actually, no. If you buy it when volatility is low, again, it depends on what time period you're using, but I tend to do longer term straddles, so maybe 3 months to 9 months. And so if there's a big volatility move, then basically the time left on your options will be worth more, because they have more vega sensitivity, i.e. volatility. So, and the way to think of it is if there's more volatility, you're just kind of, the swings are bigger either way, right? The ups and the downs. It's basically what volatility is. So therefore, the potential kind of where an option could get to in its value will go up. So we'll talk about trading vol a bit more later. So equities, I think it's just wait and see for now. It's, as I said, it's Friday. There are a lot of people out there who have, after the stimulus wasn't agreed again, but it never was going to be agreed. I mean, why on earth would the Democrats suddenly agree to something? I mean, it makes no sense, right? So I don't really think that was, I don't know what moved the market overnight. I was kind of sleeping. It could just be a whole bunch of stuff. I saw Boeing has more issues with the Dreamliner. I mean, this is literally just becoming a farce beyond anything. So, but I don't think that will be it. So as we talked about, volatility has been trending up. And so the VIX it kind of got down to roughly 2021. So that's basically that's the actual volatility, realized volatility of the last 30 days of the S&P. So that's different, by the way, to an implied volatility in an option, because that's a realized volatility. That's just a fact, right? You can calculate it. If 100 people calculate it and they're competent, they should get to the same answer. Implied volatility, which is what you're looking at when options are being priced, is derived from the pricing of the options. So it's a completely different way. So I see people get confused between those things sometimes. Again, there are some serious books on this subject, but really there's a whole ton of YouTube videos out there for introductions to volatility. So, now one thing that started to happen a couple of weeks ago was that, and it happened on, I think, the NASDAQ first, which isn't that surprising as that's been leading the move, was the VIXEN, so the volatility index for the NASDAQ, which is just the VIX, but for the NASDAQ, started to trend upwards. It was in roughly in the low 30s before. So it's been higher than the VIX, right? Because there's just more volatility in tech stocks. But it started to, go above 40. And actually, if you look at Apple's volatility, then there's a volatility index for that. Obviously, it can just be worked out. That was getting above 60. And what you were having was actually rising prices. So spots was going up at the same time volatility was going up. Now, this isn't normally what you'd expect. It's absolutely possible. Anyone that says it's not possible does not understand what volatility means. Volatility is basically how much a price is moving. It doesn't have to be that if the S&P goes up, volatility goes down. In fact, look at the gold volatility from, about a month and a half ago. It went very low. It went down to 14, 15 from memory. And then the gold price went up a ton. Like it went from 1700 or so, whatever it was, to 2050, slightly above that, really quickly. Well, that added to volatility, even though the price was going up, because it was such a big move, which is, by the way, why it kind of really needed a correction. And so this consolidation on gold has been incredibly bullish. I mean, Eric Townsend on Macro Voices has been saying, hey, let's go down further. That will be better for the bulls. And I kind of get his point. It's almost not corrected enough. But again, it could just be because it's just a great trade at the moment, owning gold. I mean, it's just look at the chart. Sure, I understand there are other potential dynamics with if real rates started to go up, i.e. if deflation, well, it became the kind of market narrative, which again, with the CPI numbers, which came out on Thursday, not suggesting yet that kind of shift from the narrative being a short-term inflation, which is kind of where we are. Well, some people thinking that's a long-term inflation. What I've noticed a few smart guys recently talking about, yeah, Q4 could easily be when we actually get that little deflationary shock because everyone's thinking inflation's coming and actually, you know, in all honesty, the world economy hasn't recovered. So I've seen Raoul talking about that, Julian Bridgen, Keith McCullough, Hedgeye. I mean, people who can flip their views much more quickly than others, right? There are people who have structural views, like my good friend Steve Amida and Lacey Hunt. Like, that's they're more structural, I'd say. They're not trying to kind of flip their view every month if data changes a little bit, and because they're super long term in the thinking, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But there are also people who are trading, you know, a little bit shorter time frames. Although Raoul tends to be relatively, you know, medium to long term, I'll kind of say. So, but it was interesting with Hedgeye, you suddenly seen, oh, maybe quad four is possible in Q4. It's going to get confusing. If we had quad three in Q3 and quad four in Q4, people will start getting confused. But remember, the way that they do quads is it's on the rate of change of the year-on-year change in GDP. So the one thing that's probably mathematically impossible next year is to have it's based on rate of change. So be careful if you see people say the words mathematically impossible with this stuff. One thing I was going to say is obviously Q2 this year was a completely, let's say, anomalous kind of GDP print. So, you know, Q2 next year is going to be a long way up. And in fact, it'll be pretty tough to imagine that Q2 next year wasn't rate of change higher on a year-on-year basis than Q1 next year. So that's, you know, now having said that, I think Hedgeye's put a lot more thought into what quad we're in than literally just that. And actually, if you look at Darius's monthly quads, we've had everything from a 1 to a 2 to a 3 to a 4 this year. But broadly for the kind of macro thing, everything has been quad 3 and quad 4. Well, actually, no, we'll call 3 this year, I think. Anyways, so bonds have sort of just been going sideways. There hasn't been any, it's kind of weird, right? So again, let's think about it through the lens of volatility. So you can look at the MOVE Index, which I think is now being published for free, or you could look at VLTLT or VXTLT, whatever the volatility index is for TLT, but that's obviously going to give you volatility of at the long end of the curve. The bond volatility hasn't really moved very much. Prices, you know, yields have certainly had some ups and downs, but broadly they've been trading in a range. With volatility not having the same dynamic as say equities where volatility was increasing, it does give me reason to believe, you know, that so for bonds, as yields go down, volatility tends to go down. Again, not always. If there's a really big move like there was in March, the volatility of course goes up. So I remain kind of long duration. This could also benefit from, you know, the US dollar's had a real kicking in the last 3-4 months. That trade isn't going to go on forever. I mean, it's had a bit of a correction, i.e. the US dollar's strengthened a bit. There's a lot of chaos in Europe with Brexit, plus resurgence of COVID. France just had 10,000 cases. It never had 10,000 cases back in April. So it's possible that, you know, again, the euro got very bought. Maybe it won't get through that 120 level against the dollar. We don't know. So this is not like a high conviction position in any way. But if the dollar does go up, that will generally be good, bad for equities, good for bonds, and probably pretty not good, maybe not bad, maybe pretty neutral for gold. The correlation of gold and dollar has come down. It was really high a few weeks ago, but it's actually been coming down if you look at on like a 15-day basis. I mean, literally correlations against the dollar, I mean, commodities, gold, equities, it had gone to like, all of them were above minus 0.95. Obviously you can't get above one, so, or minus one. So the correlations were as high as they can possibly be. That's definitely come off a bit. But, you know, so again, if you look at the US dollar, it's sort of been range bound. The DXY, I don't like the DXY because it's, you know, it's 55 or 6%, whatever it is, euro. And then, of course, if you add the pound into that, which you, in some ways, euro and the pound versus the dollar, Brexit dynamics will probably affect the euro and the pound in similar ways. Not necessarily, but the point is a lot of the Dixies are around Europe. But, you know, it's what people talk about most. It's what a lot of people trade. So we kind of have to talk about it. You know, the trade-weighted index hasn't been quite as bad for the dollar. But it's been very much range-bound between kind of 91, 93, 93 and a half the last couple of weeks. I think we just got to see which way it goes. It could fly either way. I don't really think anyone knows. Again, if we, I mean, I spoke to Brent Johnson the other day on the phone. We're talking about reserves and stuff. And I mean, he still thinks there's going to be a big spike up. Fine. Absolutely understand the logic. Whilst I've not spoken with someone like Luke Groman, you know, he's been doing a lot of shows recently where, and he still has his long-term thesis that's going down, which, by the way, Brent ultimately agrees on. But I kind of saw Luke softening a little bit in the short, medium term. Like, he knows the Dixie's moved a long way quickly. And so expecting in what he would call a counter trend move, he's absolutely thinking that's a possibility. So I, you know, I think most people here are just going to kind of wait it out and see what happens. But the next move in the dollar could be the thing that catalyzes all sorts of stuff. I mean, if you knew one thing every day in advance, let's say you had a magic time machine, the thing you'd probably want to know is not if the S&P is up or down. No, that's what CNBC would tell you need to know. What you really want to know is the dollar up or down? You can work out so much macro from that. And of course, related to that, commodities have had, you know, nice gains generally. Some have had huge gains like lumber, you know, because of the housing boom in US, people, whether it's a structural shift, we don't know, but, you know, for sure people are moving out of cities and building new homes elsewhere. But again, if the US dollar goes up, commodities will probably get a good kick in. Although they're still historically pretty cheap. The issue with commodities is it's not so easy to get pure exposure. I mean, I'm really boring on this. I just use DBA, which is agricultural commodities, but there's DBC, which is again from Invesco, which is exchange traded. Well, it's not an exchange traded fund. It must be an exchange traded note or exchange traded product, ETN, I guess, which uses futures. So it has roll yield issues, which tend to be pretty small on a lot of commodities, especially agricultural, but again, isn't necessarily the case if the weather does weird things. So I've never taken massive exposure to these types of things. There can be counterparty risk. I think I was hearing Rahul give an anecdote about a similar type of product that Lehman Brothers was a counterparty, and it actually just became worth zero in 2008. So, you know, if you own these things, you're not actually owning a pile of corn and a pile of, you know, and a massive tanker of oil. So just be aware of that. So I wanted to talk about volatility. So I saw, it was just on Twitter. There was some posts, and suddenly people were like saying how that it was mainly VXX, but VX VIXY as well, which are similar products. So the VXX is probably the best well-known quote-unquote ETF for volatility. Now you can trade VIX futures, which is of course what, but you have to be obviously trading futures for that. So anyone can buy VXX. It's a retail product. And if you're going to buy it, please do one thing. Please zoom out back to when it started, which I think was 2010, and just see that if you put in $1 million in 2010, that $1 million would now be worth about a dollar. And I'm not joking. So it loses about 6% per month on average, just because of the fact there's a contango in the VIX term structure, i.e. future. And again, this isn't always the case, but like I looked into this and on average, so they've done loads of stock, kind of quote unquote stock splits on VXX. The next one's scheduled for December 21. And if you keep splitting something by say 5-1, 10-1, you do it half a dozen times. Well, yeah, very quickly you get that 1,000,000-1 loss. It's because this is not a product designed to be held for the long term, not even the medium term. It's a product designed to be very short-term tactical trading. And you've got to be very careful if, so the way that they do it is they're rolling, they're not just moving from one futures contract to the next on a given day. They smooth it out on a day-by-day basis. So the more days you are closer to the next month, the more of that month's contract will be in there. So, but that just means there's this constant leaching out of it, you know, especially when basically futures are in contango for VIX, which they are at the moment, because why? The election in November is absolutely got a spike in the VIX in that November contract. So yes, if you can time this product right, it can be amazing. But it's not, I've seen people saying, oh, I'm just going to hold it. I'm like, well, you will literally 100% be assured to lose money unless the big spike happens, VIX goes to 60, and then you sell it and fine. Then you might be okay. But it's probably not going to get you the return you thought it would. And then people say, oh, well, I'll just buy puts in it when the VIX goes up to 80. Oh, okay. Well, if this was, because we all know VIX mean reverts eventually, right? Well, if this was the case, wouldn't every trader in the world with a brain make this trade? And the answer is, well, they would if it was guaranteed to make money. But if you buy puts when the VIX is at 80 and VXX, you're almost certain to lose money, which sounds crazy. But why? Well, because for a start, the puts are expensive. Why? Because the volatility is high. Because, well, VIX is at 80. So the volatility of VIX, which you can, again, the VVIX will show you that, means that the puts are super duper expensive, right? So they might be costing you $25, but you're like, oh, the VIX is at whatever, 60. So if it goes below 35, I'll be okay. Okay, well, first of all, you've got to, if you're doing this in VXX, you've got the roll yield issues, but you've also, but even if it gets to say 35, you might be breaking even, and it's got to do that quickly because you're losing theta all the time, right? I.e. time. And if you're buying these things on the super long term, we have all the issues we talked about before. So like, now one thing that you could do is have a small position in say VIX calls, which you buy when volatility is really low, and just with the rationale that actually it's my insurance policy. Maybe I buy them for a month at a time, duration, expiry, and I might roll them when they've got 2 weeks left to avoid the worst theta burn. But by the way, you're going to be losing almost every one of them, losing. But when that big VIX spike happens, if it does, they will then pay out crazy big. But you're going to have a structured process to do that. And I wouldn't just, you know, and when I mean a small amount, you know, you might be risking like 0.1% of portfolio a month on that. So, you know, meaning worst case in a year, you lose just over 1%. And that's basically 1% for insurance against D-Day. So my only plea to people is, if you're trading these products, please understand them. Please look at the long-term chart. If you haven't zoomed out and looked at it, or if you don't understand why the chart has the shape it has, and you can see the spikes in it, but just look at it. It's an exponential decay curve over a 10-year period. So just, yeah. And also just remember, if it was completely obvious to trade this, and it was blatantly, obviously free money, literally everyone would be doing it. So things are never that simple in liquid markets. And this, and the volatility market is incredibly liquid. It's one of the most liquid things. So you're not having this smart idea that's going to beat the hedge funds. Sorry, you're not on this one. But you might if you get the timing just perfect. But again, that's the thing, right? Investing, if you get the timing right, especially on options, that is the edge. But it's hard to do. All right, I think I've talked about that enough. So let's move to actually trading volatility, right? So we've talked a little bit about this before. Let's dive in a little more. So if you want to trade vol, yes, there are the products we just talked about, but they come with all sorts of caveats. In many ways, the easiest way to do it is with options. If you don't have options, if you don't have the ability to trade options, it's going to be more difficult. But this is a good way to learn options. And so when I first started trading options, I would buy one option. Unfortunately, you can't buy a fraction of an option. And one option would be, you multiply by 100. So it's giving you exposure to 100 shares. So again, that's not nothing if it's like an Amazon, right? At $3,000 a share. But you know, again, just do it on stuff that isn't trading at $3,000 a share. Start with something that's completely irrelevant to you if you lose it. The number one thing about trading volatility, in my opinion, is you've got to buy your insurance, which is, if you're long vol, it's insurance policy, right? You've got to buy it when it's cheap. There's utterly no point buying it like in March this year, the VIX at 80. Insurance would have cost you literally 10x more than it would have done a month prior. And that 10x was the return you would have made if you bought it a month prior. So a good example is, look at the gold chart. So a couple of months ago, if you look at GVZ, which is the volatility index, it had gone down to about 14. And those who have listened to my podcast for a while will remember me saying, I'm using this as a buying opportunity to buy long-term, out-the-money gold calls. Why? Because that was the realized volatility at 14. So that the long-term volatility was still higher. I mean, this was like 2 years out, but it was still, it had come to a nice low position versus where it was. So my point was, well, gold vol is low, that is bullish generally. And this was before it broke out. I didn't realize how quickly it would break out. That was luck. So you could say I timed it well in some ways, but really that was luck, because remember, I bought options that were 2 years out, so expiry. So if I'd done 2 weeks, it would have been vastly higher payout, of course. But the point is, I'm keeping them. But the real point is to buy when volatility is low, not when it's high. So the simplest way to be long vol is just to own calls or puts, because they'll be worth more if volatility goes up. Even with no change in the underlying, and we're assuming not that lots of time has not passed, which could like decay the value of it. Now, there are other interesting ways that are not that complex. So one thing I have used recently on technology, and I've tweeted about this quite a few times, was to own ratio call spreads. So I was doing it with XLK because it has a nice liquid options market, and also because it's half of it's Microsoft and Apple, and that's literally half of XLK. And I actually wanted to have like a really concentrated exposure to those two stocks. And there's obviously tons of other stuff in XLK, but if two stocks are half the ETF, you know, they're really driving it. And so there I was selling one call option at say 105. This is when the market was say at 110 or something. And then I was buying two or three call options at 125 or 130. Again, it depends. So the lower the volatility is, the more options you're going to be able to buy with the premium that you got from selling that one call option. So I got it to a 3-to-1 ratio with the spread being about, I think it was $20 between where I was selling and buying. And these did really, really well. I mean, obviously then the, well, technology went up and up and up. XLK went up to pretty much 130. I didn't sell them then, but they were up 1,000%. Now the point is you can't put much money into this, right? Because there's downside on this. You've sold an option too. So your maximum downside is going to be at the price where you at the expiry of the call options that you bought. So say you sold a call option at 105, then you're going to lose money between 105 and you'll have maximum loss at 125 if that's where you bought the call options. Because after 125, there's going to actually be value to those call options you bought. But the actual, the maximum loss is there, but you're still making a loss until well into the 130s, depending on the ratio. So I always model these out in Excel. They're easy to do, but the nice thing is you can know your maximum loss. And the loss is always less because there's theta, which is going to add to the value because you own more calls than what you sold. So unless something very odd happens to the structure, you should never be worse than the maximum loss. And ultimately, if you hold them to expiry, the maximum loss is your maximum loss. So I think it worked out that, like, I'm trying to remember exactly, but I think every... So if you say selling one call at 105 and buying three at 125, whatever it was, that's kind of a unit. So each unit had its maximum loss. I think I'd worked it out was a few $1,000 per unit, but the actually upside is unlimited because you've in effect got three call options on the upside. And of course, if everything just crashes massively, everything's worth zero. So you don't lose any money. So it's a really nice way of, and again, if volatility goes up, these will do great. So what was happening was volatility was going up at the same time the underlying was going up. So actually they paid out really well, but you can't risk a lot of money in it. Like there's a, so percentage gains are sort of irrelevant because you're really selling the option to get a premium to buy the call options. It's much better to think of it how much value do you have at risk. So that's another way. You can do it with puts as well, of course, ratio put spreads. Another way that is, again, doesn't make sense at first, but is very common is to use straddles. And in some ways, this is going to get you it's not going to get you pure exposure to volatility, but a straddle is when you're going to buy a call and a put, the same expiry, the same strike price. Now, you, why would you do this? Well, you do this if you think volatility is going to increase and therefore the price is going to go up or down, but you don't know, or you have no view. You just do not care if it goes up or down. So you may care a bit, doesn't matter. But the point is if volatility goes up and the price moves, then either that call or that put will... Because volatility has gone up, both will be worth more from the theta that's left on it. But one of them will also move into the money. And so straddles can be great they are really good to buy in the calm before the storm. So if you think something's going to blow up. So I did do this with gold. I was talking with Apollo Trading back in March, whenever it was, or maybe it was February, I can't remember. I was just like, look, gold is, I was looking at everything. I'm like, well, look, the shit's going to hit the fan. Gold's going to move. We don't know if it's going to get liquidated or to fly upwards, but something's going to happen. And we actually both bought straddles on GLD. And they actually, only for a couple of months of duration, and they paid out very, very quickly within a couple of weeks. Now, of course, these can also go to zero. Right. When your time, if the underlying doesn't really move, it's hard for them to go to exactly zero. That would mean the underlying would have to be exactly at the strike. But yeah, they can pretty much go to zero if there isn't much movement. So you want to think about, you know, if you're buying them with a 2-week expiry, you need movement fast or you're going to lose money on it fast. Versus if it's a 9-month expiry, you have some time. So like I've said before, my style is always like longer term. So for stuff like SPY straddles or QQQ straddles, XLK straddles, whichever one you want to do, I'm thinking more like a 9-month time period, and then I'll roll them maybe 6 months in when there's 3 months left, because you get the worst theta burn at the end. And by the way, if all this terminology doesn't make sense, I'm going to explain it in a second. But equally, like if you're trading the options and you're not understanding this terminology, you've got to do more research, because you're pretty much trying to drive a car when you're blind. And it doesn't have autopilot. But look, there's lots of different views on how to really trade long vol. But straddles, I think, are very interesting. And if vol changes, they can pay out really quite nicely and quite fast. And you can, it's easy to go longer term. You've not got the roll yield issues. Like there are benefits to it. So look, with options, like a lot of people listen to this super experienced, some are just not. If you're in the latter category, it doesn't matter. Just start small, get used to it. Don't be a hero. Don't think, oh, here's the options trade that's going to make me a billionaire. Because I've worked out, look, I can sell buy VXX puts or whatever. And like people trading options in institutions are very smart. They have a lot of experience. If there were just completely obvious trades that with the current narrative in the market you think are going to pay out like 10x for sure, then are you sure? Now, by the way, if you have a counter narrative view, for example, if you think we're going to have a bunch of deflation in the next 3 to 6 months versus runaway inflation, so I would say the market view right now is probably more inflationary. If you have a counter market view, then absolutely options can pay out handsomely. I'm just saying that if your view is the same as the market and you think there are big dislocations, just be careful. By the way, sometimes there are, but on the most liquid options markets, that tends to not be the case. I remember some of the most liquid markets in the world are the large options markets, right? You know, volatility, just SPY, Eurodollar, like these things. So, and the way, and on the Greeks, which, you know, are the various symbols behind options, it looks very daunting at first, but the way I think about it is just, you should easily be able to understand theta. It's just time decay, right? So option is buying you time for something to happen. The less time there is for it to happen, the less the option's worth. And if time is zero and your option's not in the money, it's worth zero. That's it. Most theta, so when you say theta burn or theta burn, that's when you're losing every day just time, and you lose the most. So say you have a 9-month option, you'll lose most of that in the last 3 months of it, be just roughly 50% of it, just over 50%, I think, and it depends. But the first 6 months you actually won't lose so much. So that's why you buy longer term options, you can roll them when they've got a few months left. Now, longer term options are going to give you less upside versus if you buy a 2-week option in something and you nail the price movement. But hey, it's risk reward, right? So you hear about Vega. So the way I think of this is just how it relates to theta. So Vega is just the sensitivity to volatility. So if volatility is going up, i.e. Vega's going up, then your option in effect is the potential prices that the underlying could get to. It's like a cone, like the megaphone pattern, right? Like the bigger the volatility, the wider the potential outcomes are. There's less certainty. So therefore, it's high volatility. And actually for an option, that's good. It's going to be worth more because it has the potential to get more in the money. And then the other, so I think theta and vega are very related, and delta and gamma are very related. So delta is just a change in price of the option with a change in the underlying. So if the underlying goes up 1 and the delta is 0.9, then the option's gone up 0.9. So if you're deeply, deeply in the money, this will be 1, the delta, or for a put, -1. And gamma is just the rate of change of delta. So yes, you've got to know calculus, but when you keep hearing about gamma and dealers being short gamma, it's just because if, let's say, SoftBank, which it turns out they have bought a bunch of call options that are, well, I don't know if they were in the money, out of the money, whatever, but they were call options. So basically they, as the market went up, what happened was they were getting either, well, they were probably out the money at first, they were getting in the money. So the delta was going up, and was going up faster because the gamma was increasing, because they were getting more and more and more in the money. So delta was going towards 1. And again, we don't know the exact option trades they made, but just trying to illustrate it. And so therefore the dealers on the other side, market makers, had to keep buying stock to hedge themselves, because these options were worth more and more and more and more. And remember, each option is really 100 shares. So this became this reflexive kind of loop, self-reinforcing, but it can work the other way too, right? Can also work on the downside. So for me anyway, I'll be looking at the delta. If I'm buying a long-term out the money option, I'm not too bothered about the delta, because, you know, at first it's probably not going to move a huge amount. It's going to be much more sensitive to volatility. But, you know, if you're buying something that's, say, a leap, so that's long-term equity appreciation, so you've got something that's maybe, you might want to be checking deltas near 1, so you're getting kind of a almost 1-to-1 correlation with the underlying, and then gamma isn't a thing. Well, because it can't go above 1, delta, so, and it could go down. So again, it just depends. So when people say, like, some people say, well, I only trade this one, or I only look at this one. I don't see why you can't just learn what they all mean and work out that they have different meanings in different situations, which is really no different to anything and any data. It's like someone that says, I only look at this one piece of macro data. Well, okay, that might be great, but, you know, why not look at 100 pieces? Because it's very easy to, and have that kind of picture in your mind about how everything's fitting together. Anyway, there's tons of information on this. And by the way, some people may disagree with how I describe these things, in that I've deliberately not tried to make it too technical. So I wanted to end on like a update on reserves. So again, I get questions on this, and it's kind of funny because for a lot of us, this started with people like Dr. Lacey Hunt, who, for those who've been listening for a while, you know, I spoke to him a few months ago, did a pretty much a podcast about it. And then people like Steve Van Meter and others, you know, have been very much of the view that, you know, we're in a deflationary environment, that QE is deflationary. This is backed up by Milton Friedman and blah, blah, blah. And that we shouldn't worry about hyperinflation because there's far too much debt. There's even more debt in the economy. This is going to slow growth even more, meaning that we have an even worse situation, right? And there's more debt, and then we slow the economy more, and this is how you become Japan. Now, there are people that have a different view. Probably Luke Groman, Lynn Olden, some degree, but I think nuanced, I'd say, in her views. And there's all sorts of stuff in the middle. So I've been trying to just talk to people in the industry that actually have real life jobs that know about this stuff. And one of the key questions is on reserves. So to remind people, the way it works is that when the Fed buys bonds, i.e. quantitative easing, they can only buy them from basically bulge bracket banks. So, depository banks that have a reserve account at the Fed, and they do it from the big guys who are the primary dealers. So you hear primary dealers all the time, but like JP Morgan's a primary dealer, Bank of America are. Now there are some people who are primary dealers who are not like big bulge bracket banks, but let's just assume the same thing for now. And so the Fed buys $1 billion of bonds off Bank of America. The Fed does not put money in Bank of America's like checking account somewhere. They actually credit them with reserves at the Fed. And that is the point of the money creation. Again, I'm very aware that I use this term money creation, and some people are turning in their grave right now saying, oh my God, they haven't created money, because it's not money, because it's not a unit of exchange or whatever. I get it. It's impossible. What I've come to the realization in the last 2 weeks is it is not possible to talk about this subject for more than 5 minutes with someone saying you're wrong, because you're going to use a term that someone disagrees with. It's literally impossible. So I just do not care if you have some terminology issue with what I say. It's obvious what I'm trying to say, right? And by the way, no one agrees on the exact terminology anyway. Now, if you think what I'm saying is just wrong, that's different, as in the actual substance is wrong, then please let me know. So, for example, Steve was on Real Vision, and there were some comments, and one of the commenters was, I think you're just wrong. Here's why. By the way, I've worked in the central bank, and I've worked at large banks too. So I talked to the guy, had a really good conversation. I didn't think it was all wrong. He thought bits of it were wrong. Very, very smart guy, and has actually genuinely been involved in the, you know, for his day job, day to day, in these types of transactions. So, you know, I saw a lot of people trying to guess on Twitter about how this stuff works, and not that many people actually speaking to people. I did speak with Brent Johnson, who has spoken with over 10 people to try and solve this. And again, doesn't have a simple answer, which he's been kind of, you know, putting out there in tweets recently. And but what I seem to be comfortable on now, but I'm not saying is 100% exactly what happens, but I came to the conclusion that I think it was Thursday last week. And then I saw George Gammon put a video out on the weekend. And then I saw Brent was tweeting about it. But this was all, I think, unrelated. I hadn't spoken to either of these guys at that point. So I think a lot of us came to the same conclusion at the same time. But I hadn't personally put this out on Twitter. So, but you never know how, like, you know, I do talk to people about stuff and ideas go around. But, or we could have also just got here independently to the same answer. But the key point being, there's broadly two ways, there's two scenarios when the Fed buys bonds. So it could be buying bonds off JP Morgan. And then the mechanism we've said, I don't think is disputed by anyone. JP Morgan's reserve account at the Fed gets credited with extra reserves, and the Fed takes the bonds off JP Morgan's balance sheet onto the Fed's balance sheet. Done. That's it. This does not increase M2. Because the reserves, by definition, are part of the monetary base. And the only overlap between the monetary base and M2 is, and you should know this, and if you don't know it, go and study it, is actual hard currency. So the actual notes and coins. And so the rest of the monetary base is reserves. That is not in M2 at all. But M2 did go up a lot in March. I mean, it did. But it's complex. There's lots of things in M2, right? You can look at the H.6. Oh my God, you thought I was going to say the H.8, right? Which is the table I always bang on about. There's more tables. H.6 shows you the latest, basically, M2 numbers for the US. And so in March, around then, you know, because the CNI loans went up by, I think from memory, it was 800 billion, deposits had shot up by several trillion in the US, which of course meant, and that's the biggest part of M2. But, you know, it doesn't mean the rest of the increase was from QE. People could just be selling any form of asset. You could have sold some stocks and then had cash in the bank, and we've just increased M2. So, you know, there's lots of different parts to it. But interestingly, the second and more subtle part is if the Fed buys bonds off JP Morgan, but JP Morgan is actually selling them on behalf of a client of JP Morgan. So think of it as an insurance company. So an insurance company does not have a depository account at the New York Fed. JP Morgan does. all the Fed can do is credit you with reserves. That's it. So if the insurance company, I don't know, MetLife, whoever it is, right, wants to sell $1 billion of bonds, they go to a bank, which is how an obvious way of selling it. And the bank's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, sure. In effect, the bank's just an intermediary. And actually, these bonds never touch the bank's balance sheet. And so and in this case, the bank has, they've bought the bonds off MetLife. They've created a deposit for MetLife. So that's a creation of money. So bear that in mind. And then the Fed's bought them off the bank and increased the reserves. Okay. So here you have increased M2. Now, by the way, MetLife could have just gone and sold those bonds to a foreign investor, let's say, who had, or a foreign bank who then, you know, and bought the money back into the US or whatever. Like, again, like, I'm not trying to claim this is just a very simple, pure process, but point is, in that scenario, you have increased M2. Now the question becomes, what percentage of the QE goes through mechanism one versus mechanism two, to which I don't know. I've looked into it. I couldn't work out a simple way. There's too many variables. My suspicion, and I think, I don't want to put words in Brent's mouth, I think he was at maybe a similar view in terms of, we're guessing, by the way, but like the first mechanism is probably the majority. The second mechanism, therefore the minority, is it 20%, 30%? The second mechanism, we don't know. It's probably not 1%. Pretty sure the second mechanism is not 99%, but we don't know. You can look at, for example, every treasury auction, how much was bought by primary dealers, how much QE is being done. But then again, they could be, bonds could be maturing during the month. It's not a simple calculation. But some QE does for sure get into M2. It's exactly what the data say anyway, if you look back. So, you know, the whole, what a surprise, like the whole thing when people are like, well, no, it's impossible to get into M2. And others are like, well, it absolutely gets in all into M2 or whatever. Like, the reality is sort of in the middle. We don't know how much in the middle or one way. And it means it's more subtle. So, you know, saying QE has no effect on the inflation of asset prices, i.e. risk asset prices, many people have said that. In some ways, it's a nonsensical thing to say because we just need to look at what's happened, and it's kind of fairly obvious, except you can't just do a chart of Fed balance sheet versus NASDAQ, right? I mean, you have no idea what's the causation. Just because it's correlation, it doesn't mean there's causation. This is a classic thing in statistics, right? And I'm amazed on Twitter with all these two-axis charts and all this stuff, how so few people ever bother to try and answer this question. I mean, hey, you could even say, well, do real yields drive gold? Or is gold driving real yields? Well, okay. If you can answer that, let me know. Sometimes there's more subtle questions to be asking. By the way, it could be both. It could be sometimes it's driven, this drives this. Other times, actually, you know what? The market's driving the price of gold up or down or whatever, and that's driving real yields up or down or up. Like, point is, it's not always so. It's not always the same dynamics. So that's nice. We've got these two mechanisms from the bank balance sheet, QE is being bought from the bank balance sheet, and then from a third party balance sheet. Fine. So now we know there's ways M2 can go up. Fine. And then what that pension fund, or indeed it could be hedge fund, it could be you or me, what we decide to do with that deposit is up to us. We could leave it as deposit. We could buy Tesla stock, we could do whatever we want. Also then, by the way, you're going to struggle tracking what has been done with that money, because again, like, if you then decide to buy some stock from your bank account, that's not like that's easy to track. But the big thing that came out of all these conversations was that if there's one thing, if you don't want to get confused with all this reserve stuff, which I very much understand if you don't, look at the lending data. So the H.8, which comes out weekly, I've got it in front of me right now. It's on the Feb site, by the way. For this, I'd use the seasonally adjusted stuff. there are some debates whether you should use the non-seasonally adjusted because of what happened in the last few months. And we just saw it with the initial jobless claims. They changed the methodology because the seasonal adjustment methodology was basically, well, it was kind of laughable because they were assuming similar trends to previous years when everything's changed this year, right? So, but of course, what a surprise, it brought the numbers down, which then people like, well, Trump's nobbled the BLS or whoever does it. And it's like, well, maybe he has, maybe he hasn't, I don't know. But the previous methodology wasn't very good for what was going on. Because it's kind of pretty obvious this year was not similar to previous years. I mean, there will be some underlying similar seasonal trends, of course. But then you've got this gigantic mega kind of 800-pound gorilla on top of 30 million people or whatever the number is. That I mean, that's another number that no one can agree on, that have lost their jobs. So anyway, for credit, which is basically what the H.8 is showing, commercial assets and liabilities of banks in the US. And there's less variability on this in terms of the seasonal adjustment, non-seasonally adjusted. So I'm on a non-seasonally adjusted, and really it comes out every Friday. I wake up on a Saturday morning because I'm in Asia, and I look at, first thing I look at, I look at commercial industrial loans. But I look at the overall bank credit, but again, that's a number, you know, it's about 15 trillion at the moment. And then I'm really going to look at commercial industrial loans. I'm going to look at the non-MBS, which is row five. That's treasuries. So have banks bought treasuries or not? And they've been buying treasuries. So in the last year, banks have about 200 billion more treasuries than they had. So from 850 billion to 1,150 billion. It's quite a lot more, right? By the way, that's exactly what China sold. They've sold about 200 billion in that time period. It's kind of interesting, right? I'm not trying to say they're related. It's just a coincidence, but I'd also look at consumer loans. So again, you can see consumer loans tend to have just gone up and up and up before, but it's actually been trending flat to down. What's clearly trended down is credit cards. Auto has been basically flat. So there's a lot of interesting data in this. And why is this so important? Because this is where money is created. And again, someone, I don't think that is controversial, because the Fed does create money in one way when they create banknotes, so coinage, right? But that's a tiny weeny part of everything. Where the real money that matters is created is in deposits, i.e., when loans are created. So when a bank makes a loan, it is an asset for the bank. And they also have a liability which matches it in the T account in the balance sheet. The liability is the deposit that is the money that you see. That money doesn't exist. There's no, you know, bank note. There's, you know, it has $1 million. There's not $1 million in your account somewhere, right? People know this, right? You understand that, but you can spend it. Now the bank has to have an amount of reserves. Well, all right, the reserves right now requirement is zero, but they have to have liquidity requirements. There's a whole bunch of requirements that mean they can't just like lend infinite money. But you know, when I was speaking to the treasurer of a large regional bank in the US, I won't say which one it is, but like, and they confirmed what the H8 data say, which is, well, you know what, there's just not massive demand right now for commercial and industrial loans. And it's the bank that does a lot of them normally. And it's like, well, it's not like there's no demand, but you know, it's, you can see it, you know, in the data that comes out every week. This data's not lying. So it's nice when you see high level data and then you're speaking to someone on the front line. It's like, well, yeah. And by the way, he also confirmed to me that no limitation to their lending based upon the reserves they have. If they had more reserves at the Fed, that would not mean they could lend more. They have plenty of capacity to lend. So this whole get reserves, you can lend more, this is just not the narrative. And I think a lot of people have worked that out. But again, it's nice to hear it from the coalface too. So banks, and you just need to look at the senior loan officer survey from Q2. It'd be really interesting to see the Q3 one, which will come out, I think it's about a month lag. So it'll probably come out early, mid-October. I think that's a fascinating survey because for Q2, it's pretty obvious banks are going to tighten lending standards, right? But what's happened in Q3? I think that's, and what happens in Q4 will be one of the most defining points of this cycle. Because if banks are not lending, right now, you know, if commercial industrial loans, which peaked at peaked at 3,040 billion in May. It's now down to 2,785 billion. That's down almost 10%, right? And don't forget, it spiked up to the 3 trillion because of everyone pulling revolvers. So everyone that could pull credit lines did in March, April, because, well, you'd be kind of stupid not to, and the bank can take those away from you. So if this commercial industrial loans keeps trending down, then that's a huge problem for the economy. And it would be, it's basically, if you can't see credit expansion in this H8 table, and right now there's not credit expansion, broadly overall bank credit has been flat for a few months. But in a fiat-based economy, you need credit expansion to drive the economy. And so if you can't see the credit expansion in this table, it's going to be relatively hard to see how you're going to get crazy inflation happening. Now, of course, there's the subtleties of, well, you have M2 and velocity of money. You've got to multiply these things together, in effect. Obviously, velocity of money has tanked. But again, of course, it was always going to tank in Q2. And so real question is going to be, well, what happens to it in Q3 and Q4? And this is where I'm seeing the emergence of a counter trend trade that is getting, I would say, more smart people in the early stages of trying to work it out, which is that Q4 might end up being more deflationary than people think. We've had that little bounce, quite common in recessions. You have like a little mini reflationary bounce. And in effect, people are hoping stuff's going to be fine. The big unknown, of course, is the election. But I'm just seeing that emergence of that thought from of several people I respect, less so from people who are kind of trading day to day, more so from the kind of more people who are macro thinkers, are seeing, well, wait a minute, the market's positioned for thinking there's going to be inflation. I mean, bond yields have been nudging up a bit. The break evens, so TIPS have done really well. LTPZ, which I've mentioned before, has done not as well because obviously it's also got the duration angle. And so some people thinking about fading the kind of TIPS move, although you listen to, say, Keith at Hedgeye, and you'll be like, well, TIPS have done great. There's no signal yet to suggest that. So why are we trying to all be so smart and guess what's going to happen? When, why don't we just look at the data? Which I kind of totally get his view on that too. So there's something to watch. The kind of, in effect, what's the ratio of inflationistas to deflationistas? And has it kind of, it's like a put-call ratio, right? You know, has it peaked with maximum inflationistas and now we're going to get more of the deflationistas coming through and having louder voices, which can change a market narrative? And if that happens, by the way, the US dollar will explode upwards, most likely. And I'm assuming in the absence of some giant stimulus bill, which is just not happening at the moment. Now that could all, of course, change if the Dems or Republicans sweep in November, all three parts of the election, i.e. the House, the Senate, and the presidency. But yeah, if you're completely set up for inflation, so i.e. stuff like silver, commodities, inflation protected bonds of different things, you might be short US dollar, tech stocks, like, you know, this type of stuff. If this narrative does change, it can change very quickly to you have the DXY at 98.99 before you can say boo. Bond yield, 30-year bond yields below 1%, and if you're not set up for that move, it can happen very fast. So you've got to make that decision. You want to be, so I'm hedged either way right now. I'm relatively balanced between the two. I'm probably slightly more exposed because of my, it depends how you look at Bitcoin and gold, right? I mean, gold, you can argue that if deflation comes, it's bad for gold because real yields go up. But I could also argue, yeah, but if there's significant deflation, the world's pretty fucked up. People are probably wanting the safety of gold too. So for me, gold probably doesn't do well if everything's just kind of boring and everything grows at 1.5%. And yeah, But, you know, I think that's, I don't know, that could happen. I.e. if we go into just, you know, some very long, very, very, very long and slow recovery. But I think it'll be a bit more volatile than that. So again, you've got to just think about, people ask me about portfolio construction, and I did a podcast on it. I didn't publish it because I wasn't happy with it. And because I was like getting too much into details of how much to have in what assets. And I just realized, it's like, guys, like, you, first of all, you've got to work this out for yourself. But number two, like, it changes all the time. I mean, you know, you could just, if your view on inflation and deflation changes, you know, you might be someone that wants to be set up for one or the other, or you might be someone that wants to be set up for either scenario, because actually you're not worried about necessarily making a bunch of money, but you don't want to lose money. So if you're sitting there with $10 million in your brokerage account versus $10,000, well, you're going to have a very different view of the world, right? To $10,000, well, you ain't going to live off that. So you're going to have to take some higher volatility bets if you want to grow that fast. Now, if you have the $10 million, you think differently. And if you have $10 billion, you think differently again. So that's why I haven't done that episode. But some advice on it would be to start with... on all that, like, just for your portfolio construction, it's completely dependent on who you are. If you're interested, and if there are, if it's very much dependent on how much stress you're on in your life. So do you want to be checking your phone 10 times a day or more? And by the way, there are several people that check it hundreds of times a day. Because you have, in effect, what I would call high stress positions that could go either way. You need to be monitoring the market. This is what some people want, right? Other people want the complete opposite, which is, well, you know what? I want to look at my portfolio once a week. I think if you're only doing it once a month, that's probably like so passive, that's maybe not enough. But, and you know what? I don't mind if I'm not trying to get the tops or the bottoms. I want to be right on trends. And you know what? In the long run, that'll be good. So I'm kind of more in the middle between those two, but slightly longer term versus shorter term. It could just be, you know what? I'm going to go on holiday. Well, right now, I don't think we're doing this, but... I'm going to go on holiday, a long holiday. It's over summer for a month. I don't want to think about this stuff. Well, you know what? We don't have a bunch of like either leveraged or option positions that can change in 2 seconds, right? It might be more cash in the portfolio then. Point is, it's a living, breathing thing, right? The problem is, if people have allocations sometimes, it must be this, it must be this. They get so wedded to this asset. So why is it logical to be wedded to a piece of gold or a, I don't know, corn? I'm just making up commodities, right? Or indeed a stock. Like, why be wedded to Microsoft or Tesla? I mean, who cares? It's just a thing. It's irrelevant. Like, so what I'm trying to say is, like, take emotion out of it. And there's always emotion in trading. I get it. But like, try and take it out of it. Some people just want to be right more than they want to make money. Well, often if you're right, you do make money. But sometimes you can be right and lose money because you can get the timing wrong. So, and that's very true, by the way, in options trading. One thing there, I'm always willing to sacrifice upside to get more time, because often these things can just take longer to play out. So I think that's a pretty good tip. So I'm not going to do a podcast on portfolio construction precisely because it should be different. But I think with the 32 podcasts we've done so far, one could listen to them and I think anyone should be able to work out what's right for them based upon the stuff we've talked about. And at the end of the day, it has to add to 100%. You might be running long short, right? But still has to ultimately add to 100%. And it's only you that can make those decisions. So, all right, let's leave it there. So, let's see what happens. Maybe I'll do another one of these if the markets kind of go crazy Friday or indeed next week. But it just feels like a time right now that if you don't have strong views on things, don't trade. You don't need, sitting on your hands is fine. You know, I've sold out of a little bit of some positions just to have a little bit more cash, not massively, but just not that I believe cash is a good thing in the long run, because governments seem pretty hell-bent on eviscerating it, but it does give optionality. If there's a real crash, everything will crash. I mean, let's just assume correlations go to -1, right? All correlations go to 1 or -1, right? And the -1 will be the US dollar, as in March. You know, even bonds had, US treasuries had issues, right? I'm not saying that will happen. It could. Be prepared for it. If you think volatile times are ahead, take advantage of when volatility has decreased to think about maybe some long volatility trades. And then, you know, one thing maybe we go into more in a subsequent one is the election. There's still anything could happen, right? And, you know, for me, it's like, if one of the two parties sweeps all three, well, that's when you could see real market shifts, right? Because that means real, real stuff can happen. Although if you don't have 60 votes in the Senate, you can't necessarily change certain things. So although theoretically you could change the rules to get rid of the 60, like McConnell did with the Supreme Court. So yeah, I guess who knows? But the, yeah, and we polls in some ways got it wrong last time, but Biden's a lot further ahead than Clinton was at this point. But it doesn't mean Trump's out. And if someone wins the presidency, say it's a Dem, say it's Biden, and they have the House but not the Senate, well, you could have 4 years of deadlock, or 2 years, right? Because the next cycle will be in 2 years. Like, you generally could just have nothing happen. There might be no stimulus. Well, if there was no stimulus, again, markets are not expecting that. Maybe bond yields crash down, dollar goes up a lot. That's a potential, you know, I mean, for not having that, and all that would mean is you just, the only change would be Biden beating Trump. Senate stays the same, House stays the same. Like, both sides can dig their feet in and not sign off on stimulus because of the way the system works in the US. That would not be possible in the UK, for example. If you had a majority in the House of Commons, you can basically do what you want, after a little bit of back and forth, but ultimately you can do what you want. So, and I also think maybe just holding, one idea I had was just maybe to just hold a bit more cash versus actual investments going into the election, simply because we just don't know what's going to happen. And you know what, if something moves a lot, it's a nice buying opportunity potentially. So anyway, let's think about more that more another day. Thanks again for listening. And as always, look, if you like this stuff, if you could, you know, I never really ask for this. I never ask when guests are on because it's embarrassing. If you like it, please leave a like, leave a review, say whatever you want in the review on whatever podcast service you use. You could share things you thought were cool on social media. That would be great. You know, we, as you know, we started, we had like tens of people listening, and then that moved to kind of hundreds of people when I started doing the interviews, and now we're getting thousands. So it's, you know, it is getting more people listening, which is cool, but it's still tiny. But I think the quality of people who are listening is very, very high, and I, you know, I've been getting more really good questions as well. So happy to answer those. Just DM me on Twitter. That is the best way. And by the way, if you, this is another, I put a tweet out, but I didn't get any replies that helped. If you know anyone, or if you are someone that understands from first-hand experience how reserves work, it doesn't have to be in the US because it's, I think, broadly consistent in Western countries. But if you have actually made those trades where you've been in treasury at a bank, or or you've actually interfaced with central banks or whatever it might be, and you have firsthand experience and you're willing to chat, you don't have to come on the podcast, but just to chat on the phone, it take 20 minutes, then please let me know. Cause I'm always willing to learn more on this and be wrong or right or whatever. But it's, you know, the inflation deflation debate right now is sort of the, I'd say probably one of the most important debates, and this is kind of at the heart of it. So, all right, let's leave it there. Thanks, guys. Bye.